tonight on Arena. Dublin hip-hop from Khaki Kid, Peter Murphy and Colm McAnamara on Ghost Voltage, and we review this week's new films. You can text us on 51551, please do. Drop us an email to arena@rte.ie and you'll find us on Instagram at @RTE_arena. Tonight on Arena's film reviews, An Ultimate Fighter, A Nuclear Disaster and A Fascinating Reconstruction. In The Smashing Machine, director Benny Safdie gives us Dwayne The Rock Johnson, as we've never seen him before, but in a role that he was probably born to play. Director Kathryn Bigelow is back with A House of Dynamite, a muscular tale of potential military disaster with the most serious consequences possible. Urchin is Harris Dickinson's feature debut as a writer-director and tells the story of a homeless man trying to escape the clutches of addiction and violence. And Jim Sheridan brings us Recreation. It's a speculative feature film centering on the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier. Cara O'Doherty and Declan Burke have been to the pictures. First start, though, we'll address the question almost nobody had been asking to prior to 6 months ago. Can Dwayne The Rock Johnson finally win an Oscar? The Smashing Machine opens this weekend and he stars alongside Emily Blunt. He plays the real-life mixed martial arts star Mark Kerr. Declan, it's about a real person, but it's quite an unusual sports film. Maybe tell us where we are when we join the story.
It is unusual. Rick, you're right. It's 1997, which is very much the early days of the Ultimate Fighting Championship, or UFC. In fact, the character of Mark Kerr, who's played by Dwayne Johnson, he comes into the sport as an ex-wrestler, a free-form wrestler, and he is effectively indestructible. He's unbeatable in the ring. In the ring, he's brutal, he's vicious. Outside, he's very pleasant and easygoing, very nice chap. But he has never had to process or intellectualize, as he says himself, the concept of losing. So his life is terrific. He's in a relationship with Dawn, who's played by Emily Blunt. Life is just absolutely wonderful for him. Dum, 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 until what we would consider the inevitable happens. He is defeated in the ring, and then he has to try and put all the smash pieces of his life back together again.
What kind of character is Kerr, Cara? Because he's got addictions of two different kinds here. He is addicted to winning, but he's also addicted to medication as well.
He is quite an interesting guy because he really is this giant hulking beast of a thing who has no problem battering the life out of people in the ring. And outside, he is so calm and meditative and speaks to reporters in this almost sweet, hushed tones. So he's this kind of very odd mix, but he isn't losing, but he is getting some serious knocks. So he's in chronic pain. He's eating, he's injecting drugs. I mean, the size of him, I think he'd need enough to fell an elephant. And he has this problem then, obviously, with the fear of losing. But yeah, he can't even contemplate it. So he speaks to a reporter and he can't even get words out because this is so beyond comprehension to him. So on the one hand, he's this beast. Then he's this very kind, gentle man. But at home, he's a bit of a mixture because he very much loves his partner. But they have a turbulent, rocky relationship. He's never violent towards her, but there's a few doors that get smashed in. There's a few bits of furniture that go flying around. So he's this very odd kind of mixture of this incredibly violent man who likes to be all kind of Yoda-like, calm and sensitive as well. So he's quite a kind of a conundrum.
I think this clip might help illustrate that perfectly. So this is Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Emily Blunt, who is his girlfriend, in a scene from The Smashing Machine. They're at a fun fair and she is determined to go on a particular ride. It is a Wall of Death style ride and he's not overly sure about that.
There's no way I can ride that.
Why?
Well, because of my tummy. You know what that would do to my tummy. I would get sick everywhere.
No, it's about perspective, okay? On the inside, you don't feel it. It's like you're not moving. You're like pinned against the wall and you're going to love it.
Does it move on the inside?
It moves, but it's moving so fast that you can't even feel it.
I really want to go on the ride with her, but I have a sensitive stomach. Is there the center part in there? That's the thing that stays still, right? Can I stand in there, in the middle part?
In the center part?
Yes.
No, that'd be a serious liability issue.
Well, where would you recommend I stand then? Because I don't want to get sick on the ride, but I do want to ride with you.
You don't want to get sick on the ride? I would suggest you don't go on the ride if you can't handle it.
Okay. Well, it's not that I can't handle it. It's just I'm choosing not to go on.
Okay, I'm going to go on the ride. You're going to hold my cake. You're going to hold my bag.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Wish me luck, okay? Thank you.
And he holds the cake and the bag, and she goes on the ride. Declan, how much do you need to know about mixed martial arts fighting, the UFC sort of fighting of this world going into the film?
I would say very little. I'm not a fan myself, Rick. The basics are fairly straightforward as far as I can make out. You go into a ring, you go into a cage, and you do whatever it takes to defeat your opponent. Now, in the film, after about 10 or 15 minutes, because it's the early stages of the UFC, back in the late 90s, there is a press conference in which the organisers announce a number of rule changes, and that allows the makers of the film to kind of clarify for the viewer what exactly is allowed and what isn't allowed.
One in particular is eye gouging. Is all of a sudden not allowed, even though it was allowed before?
Yes, which some people might say is a bit of a shame, but I would say yes, no, that's a very good idea not to gouge people. You're not allowed to knee people in the head anymore when they're facing down or facing up. I can't remember the rules, but they are all clarified. If you're not a fan of UFC, you won't feel left out.
You can still kick people in the head, though. That's fine. It's just no kneeing them in the head.
As
kicking
long as they're
them
facing
the
up the way, that's allowed.
Is there an element, Cara, that if you're squeamish about that kind of violence, that this film may not be for you at all?
Yes. Now, I have to say, I am quite a fan of the sport and I do not object to a bit of violence. So for me, it was fine. But I do know some people who would be, they'd be squirming in their seats. There's a few moments of that. Now, it doesn't dominate the film, but there are a couple of moments where I'd say, people might find it a bit difficult to watch.
Now, I want to apologise for the pun, but let's dig down into the rock of this film. Because it is, when you see him play the role, it is hard to imagine anything that's probably more perfect for Dwayne Johnson to play.
I mean, he's extraordinary. I mean, watching him and his figure, I don't even know how he's human. He literally is a rock. It's really, I don't think anybody else. And when you see the footage of the real man at the end, there is clips of, and they're very like. Now, he does have a prosthetic nose, and that has given him quite a distinct look. But it's quite surprising to see him like that. But he does very much show a new side to himself. We're used to a rock who plays very kind of charismatic, kind of throwaway characters, and he's quite charming doing those, but this is a big change for him, and he shows a lot of layers that we haven't seen before. He is very sensitive. He's quite well able to do emotions, although he probably has a while to go yet before he really takes off. But as a first dramatic role, I think he does very well.
Declan, it's probably fair to say that he's made a career in cinema out of avoiding playing characters like this, probably quite deliberately, because he didn't want to be seen as the one note wrestling guy.
Yeah, and as Cara says, he's literally built for this role. That's what you were alluding to in the previous question. He looks CGI'd, actually. That's how ripped he looks in the part. And also a very disconcerting series of budgie smugglers, because the shorts are so small compared to him. So people might want to kind of bear that in mind too. He has a lovely...
Is that a trigger warning for his
pants?
It
was a trigger warning for me. I wish someone had warned me. He has a great kind of everyman persona that's at odds with his physical physique, usually on screen, and that works very well. He does, as Cara says, he tries to dig deeper here. I'm not saying that the deeper layers aren't available to him. I'm not sure he actually gets them up on screen. Part of the problem is that he's acting alongside Emily Blunt, who's one of the finest actresses working in Hollywood today. And she, whether deliberately or not, her character is, it's basically a one-note caricature of a nagging shrew. And I did wonder, unless this has been too generous, are we seeing her through his drug-addled perception of her? I think that's maybe a bit too generous to Benny Safdie, the writer and director. I think this certainly didn't make enough of the marvellous talent that is Emily Blunt. And I think the film kind of suffers as a result of that.
Cara, there's a thing about this as well, in that there is no traditional goody-baddie setup in this. It's not like Rocky. He is not working towards something and he has a mortal enemy who he then needs to overcome. It's not a Raging Bull-style film. It kind of takes its own path.
Yeah, and I think that's really refreshing. Now, I have to say, I am a sucker for an underdog sports film. I love that. I love Rocky. I'm saying it here. I love Rocky. But I really enjoy that this is about the demons in his head, and that his opponents and his rivals are actually his friends. And there's a lovely camaraderie between him and his sort of his trainer, who's also a fighter. Again, another guy who's a real man. And there's a really lovely dynamic there. So yeah, the battle that he has to face, the main opponent. It's what's going on in his head, and accepting that if you go into a sport, at some point you're going to lose, and you have to face facts.
Okay, there's been a lot of virtual column inches devoted to this. So for both of you, the same question. I'm going to start with you, Declan. Is he going to be in the mix for an Oscar for this?
I can't say he won't, but I'd be surprised if he will, Rick.
There is a lot of talk, and I wonder if the talk might get him there, but I don't think he'll deserve to be there.
Okay, stars for The Smashing Machine for both of you, Cara.
Do you know what? It's not perfect, but I really enjoyed it, and I am going to give it 4 stars.
Declan?
Yeah, I think it's overly long, and it's a bit too loosely structured, but it does keep us interested throughout, so 4 stars for me too.
Okay, our second film is A House of Dynamite. It's the new film by Catherine Bigelow, written by Noah Oppenheim. It's a nuclear thriller which, revealing nothing in the first 3, 4, 5 minutes of the film, you realise that there has been a nuclear launch on the United States. It is a single missile and nobody seems to know where it's come from. Cara, set the rest of that up for us. So how do you make an entire film out of that you haven't been to before?
Well, it starts with them not being quite sure, like you say, where it's coming from. But also, is it an actual nuclear, is it something that's coming for the United States? Their first thinking is this a test that nobody else has told them about? Is it something that has somebody fell asleep and pressed on a button and it's taken off? So they're not quite sure at first. And they have to start telling people, look, it's Rebecca Ferguson's character, Olivia Walker. She has to start telling the higher ups, listen, this is out there. We have it in control, it's fine. And bit by bit they begin to realise, oh, hang on, this is not okay. It is not in control. This is heading for America. So their first thing to do is call in Major Daniel Gonzalez. He is in charge of a missile defence station that they have two opportunities to knock this thing out of the sky. And whether that'll happen now is something I won't say. But bit by bit, the more the stakes get higher, the more people of importance are brought into the room. And by the time the president has come in, things are going to be very serious. But it's done through a series, almost, it's done through a video screen. We're taken through the first part of the story through Walker's view as she speaks to the higher-ups on the screen. They're brought together. And then the story resets again. And it's the next 18 minutes told from the perspective of, say, the president and what's going on from his side, or the Secretary of Defense. So we're brought into this kind of this repeating world of how each department and section is coping with the news, dealing with the news, and as they realise that it is more serious, how their personal lives begin to affect how they are reacting in the situation.
It's a really interesting device, isn't it, Declan? Because obviously in situations like this, it's hard to make a Zoom call thrilling, which is where we begin with this, because everybody is so disparate in the chain of command in the United States. But what she does is takes the 18 minutes of the film and then replays it from the points of view of different people. There are moments where you hear lines of dialogue you've heard before. There are moments where things are happening you haven't heard before. It's an interesting way to deal with it.
Yeah, it's a kind of palimpsest in terms of filmmaking. It felt at times it was almost like we were seeing the first act of a film, but from three different perspectives, or many, multiple perspectives. And that point you make about hearing snippets of dialogue or sounds off camera or things that we can't immediately decipher, or the characters, and then it's only when we see it the second time that when we're focused on the character who makes that sound or makes that statement or whatever, that we realise in context what it means. And it is a very interesting concept, and I think, and Cara alludes to this, I think what's very good about this, I mean, there's a lot of acronyms in this film, Rick. It's like filled with various comm strats and command defcons and you name it, they've got it. But what she does, what Catherine Bigelow does very good well, is she immediately gets under the skin of those kind of acronyms and gets to the heart of who the people are behind the titles and the responsibilities, and it's very well done in the way it's personalised. That we have all these multiple systems that are supposed to be fail safe, that are going to prevent these kind of catastrophes happening, but they're all contingent on human beings doing their very best in a very difficult situation.
Because it is a strange one, Cara, for a story that is ultimately about the possibility of nuclear war, and it sets out its stall at the very beginning of the film. Really, it's a film about individuals, and it's a film about how all of these people deal with what is going on around them, both in terms of their work lives and in terms of their personal lives as well.
Oh, absolutely, because like Declan says, we assume that these people are at the top of their game. They're in the highest positions because of their skill set. But at the end of the day, if a nuclear weapon is coming towards your country, it is going to have an effect on you. You're going to start thinking about family members, and bit by bit we see who is concerned about what and why they're concerned. This isn't giving anything away. There's a soldier who phones home just to say hello to his mammy. He doesn't say much more than that. So, but in just that moment, it's such a personal moment. And in that room, when he does that, no other soldier looks at him as if he's doing something wrong. So it is at the end of the day. I mean, the truth is, and we're in a scary world right now, where you know things like this are slightly more probable. At the end of the day, people are people, they're not machines. And no matter what tech you have in front of you and what weapons you have at your disposal, your personal life is going to come into it and affect you.
Tell me who impressed you in the cast most, because it is a large, fairly starry cast.
I mean, there's so many people in this. I mean, Gabriel Basso, I really enjoyed his role. He plays the Deputy National Security Advisor. He was never meant to be on this call, but the higher up is out of action. So this poor guy is kind of roped in at the last minute, and he has this, one of the things they have to start deciding, if this bomb lands, what does America do? To who do they respond to? Do they just rampantly start bombing the rest of the world? And he's very much the kind of the voice of, hang on now, whatever we do here, it's going to be devastating. So act with caution. And he's quite refreshing, because everyone else is like, press all of the buttons, fire everything. And he's just that bit younger. He obviously hasn't been in as many of these meetings. And he very much kind of stands back and goes, can you maybe just have a little think there. And Greta Lee pops up in quite a small part, again, as an advisor. She is, and it's quite funny in a way, she's at the Battle of Gettysburg, there's a reconstruction, she's watching this moment of a great American battle on the phone, guns and fire in the background, talking to the president about, you know, what might happen and who might have done it. So there's these little moments in it that quite the kind of sparkle character-wise.
Who impressed you, Declan?
Yeah, we've mentioned the president a few times. Idris Elba plays the president, and we only hear him on the phone, on the Zoom call, as you say, because his screen is blanked out. He's actually at an event. Trump basketball's around with a kids team when the news comes through. Shades of George W. Bush.
There's a little bit of George W. Bush reading
the
book
library.
About goats. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and they do lean into that a little bit, and I think he's very good. What he's brilliant at is the idea that this was always a possibility. And he got a single briefing when he turned up for his inauguration. But no one ever really thought anyone was going to be crazy enough to launch a nuclear weapon. And he is as at sea as everyone else. And he's only got one guy. He's a military guy. And basically all the military guy is there to advise him which of the best of the bad options is he going to take. And that's the kind of terrifying thing. Cara alludes to the fact that, you know, we're in a terrifying world now. When you're watching this film, you're thinking, what if this was real, given the current incumbent in the White House? We won't go there, but there is no good option in this film. This is not Independence Day. Nobody's going to swoop in and save the day.
If you watched an awful lot of cinema in the 1980s and 1990s, this is a film that falls into that subgenre of what if there was to be a moment somewhere, and there were lots of films made from very high profile ones to TV movies. Does it stand out from that genre, Declan?
It literally stands out, Rick. It stands to one side of it, and it's looking back at those kind of films, and it's almost a commentary on those to say exactly that. This idea that we have, you know, the great American hero, the loner who's going to save the... That's not a real thing. we have to be adults about this. This is our potential future.
Okay, can I get stars from both of you, Cara?
I absolutely love this. Catherine Bigelow is one of my favourite directors, and I am a little bit of a warmonger. I was absolutely...
It's been a night of revelations so
I know,
far
I'm
here.
Telling you, what do I sound like? I was gripped from start to finish. I haven't sat at the edge of my seat for a film in a long time, and I am giving this the full whack of a 5 stars.
Ooh. Okay, Declan.
Didn't quite deliver for me in the final stages, I'm afraid. I was expecting a little more, so, but a strong 4 stars for me.
Okay, we're moving on to Urchin. Could Harris Dickinson be proving himself to be the quintessential triple film industry threat? He's a good actor. He's a good-looking guy. The question is whether or not he's a good director as well. With Urchin, he graduates from music videos and shorts to writing and directing his first feature. It's about a homeless young man struggling to find redemption after committing an act of cynical violence. Declan, the film stars Frank Dillane as Michael. What sort of person is he, and where are we when we find him?
Well, we initially meet him when he's on the street, and he's in a bit of a bind because he basically stashes his rucksack behind some cardboard at night or during the day when he's out and about on the streets and so forth. When he goes for his gear, he realises his wallet is gone, and he knows who has taken it. It's another homeless guy. He fronts him up outside, I think it's a museum, and of course the guy denies it, and Mike is saying no, and eventually a fight breaks out. A bystander steps in, character called Simon, played by Okezie Mauro, and he breaks them up, gets them separated, and he asks Mike, you know, look, you're down and out. Can I buy you a sandwich? Can I get you something to drink? And Mike says, okay, that you're very good. Walks him down a dark alley and basically assaults the character of Simon brutally, robs him and runs off. And so in the first 10 minutes, we know this is a guy who is, he is charming, he's charismatic, he's likable. He was entitled to start that fight to get his wallet back, but this is a guy who is not to be trusted.
There's more than a little of a Ken Loach vibe to this, Cara, you thought?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly when he first gets out of jail, he gets caught very quickly for beating up this guy and then stealing the wallet. When he gets out of jail, he meets with this really strong social worker who sets him up in a hostel. He gets a job in a budget hotel, and it's very much that kind of Loachian social realism, and that's very strong for a while. And Dickinson has a really strong eye for that, but he also takes it down surreal routes as well. There's a kind of a recurring motif of this kind of a cave with a beautiful tree. There's also this moment where water is washing down a drain, and he follows it right down into the kind of the underground. So he has this really interesting mix of Loach and surreal, and meeting the two in the middle.
Okay, can we get stars from both of you, Cara?
It's really strong. Again, I'm going to go another 4 stars.
Okay, Declan.
Yeah, unsentimental, bracingly so. A tour de force from Frank Dillane. 4 stars for me too.
Okay, to finish it this week, after making a documentary about the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier and the subsequent investigation, director Jim Sheridan goes one step further with a feature film, Recreation, which imagines what might have happened had the now deceased chief suspect Ian Bailey faced trial in Ireland. Declan, you've seen this film. How does this combination of fact and fiction work for you?
It's very interesting, Rick. So most of the film plays out. We get a closing statement from the prosecuting barrister, played by Aidan Gillen, who declares Ian Bailey, played by Colin Meaney, guilty beyond any shadow of a doubt. And then the action moves into the jury room, and we have 11 of the jurors who are convinced of Ian Bailey's guilt. One juror 8 is played by Vicky Creeps. She's a holdout. She has a feeling, quote unquote, that he's not guilty. And then, the rest of the jurors start to tease out the evidence. The interesting aspect of it for me is that the characters, the idea of a trial, all this is fiction. But the evidence, quote unquote, that is presented against Ian Bailey, that is the kind of evidence that was presented against him in real life. So it's a very interesting conceit.
What do you think is the point of this? What do you think Jim Sheridan is trying to say with this film?
Well, the direction of the narrative leads from a holdout who suggests that Ian Bailey is innocent towards the other jurors starting to agree with her. So I presume that the point of the exercise is to tell a story about A, Ian Bailey was innocent, or B, that the evidence that was presented against him was unreliable, and that there is no, beyond reasonable doubt, he cannot be considered guilty. And it's a strange one because this is a fictional trial we're talking about. So we're using kind of legal terms about a trial that never happened. So I presume that's the point that Jim Sheridan is trying to make. And Jim Sheridan, by the way, he plays Juror One, who's also the jury foreman. So even within the context of the film, he's steering the kind of context or the conversations as they're erupting in the jury room.
There is a difference between fictionalizing stories that have happened in the 18th and 19th century, Tick House of Guinness, for instance, and something that is so fresh in people's minds. Did that feel unusual for you?
No, because we get true crime dramatizations all the time. So the short answer to that question is no. I have a slightly larger issue with the tragedy of Sophie Toscan de Plantier, in that I think it's a murder that has received an undue amount of puerile interest in this country, and I think this film is another example of that. I'm not sure if it's a necessary film. I'm sure it's a well-intentioned film, but I just don't know if it's necessary at this point in time.
And how present is Sophie in the film, if at all?
We see her first. There is news footage and so forth, so we see Sophie. We've seen these clips before. Even people who aren't really that interested in the case will have seen all this footage before. The jury characters keep referring their own life experience to draw parallels between their experience and what happened to Sophie. So she is present. And that's something that I think is, we need to doffer caps to Jim Sheridan and David Merriman on that. This is, you know, they are absolutely centred on the victim in this story.
Stars from you?
I'll go to give it 4 stars because it's an interesting conceit and because the material keeps us interested. It's a flawed film, in my opinion, but I will give it 4 stars.
Okay, Cara O'Doherty and Declan Burke, thanks for joining me tonight. The Smashing Machine is on general release. A House of Dynamite is on limited release this weekend, and then it goes on general release next weekend, and then you'll be able to get it on Netflix from October 24th. And Urchin and Recreation go on limited release this weekend. And you're welcome back to Thursday Night's Arena. In March this year, Peter Murphy, the writer and performer you might know better as Kirst Murphy, and Colm McCon Imara, the composer and violinist, as well as Killian and Lorcan Byrne from Baskerville, got together in the National Opera House in Wexford for 5 days to record an album called Ghost Voltage. The album is a prose poem requiem for the departed, divided into 6 parts, with elements of memoir, folklore, sci-fi and the supernatural, and it's accompanied by a book of the same name, illustrated by artist Mirona Mara, and the project has been documented on film as well and in photographs by Keelan Barron. I'm delighted Peter Murphy and Colm McCon Imara are with me in studio now. Before I talk to them, let's give you a little of the opening track. This is Meter Reading.
Energy of unknown origin. Our engineers can't source the signal, but it's here, twitching the meter, singing through the static, calling all our violins to prayer. The dead are quick ventriloquists, tricking voices into our throats, pulling on our sinews like puppeteers, ordering us about. They say, bear our aborted desires or suffer. We do as commanded, dance hangman jigs, ejaculate into the nettle beds. And when the soft rains come, mandrake buds will root in the mud under the gallows. Mud or blood. Dark mathematicians spoke the golem into being by breathing the name engraved in the clay at the nape of the creature's neck. To breathe into, to inspire. The dead are similar necromancers, spittling rain upon the nettle beds. And when the seasons ripen, seedlings spread beaks and legs and feet and push their crowns out of the marl, severing the umbilical cords of the root system, emerging as goblins, holding hands, prattling circles around us. Little bastards.
And that's the opening track, meter reading, from the album Ghost Voltage. Peter, the words in Ghost Voltage, they're yours. How did you come to write it?
I had written novels and journalism and stories for years and years and years. And it just reached that point where we all get to, I think, where the stories from our own family and our own, the folklore of our own family history becomes imperative or becomes as important or becomes more seductive or fertile seeming than anything you can come up with out of your own head. So there's that that idea of the old ones like dolmens around the childhood. It's there, and as you get older and you reach the age of maybe your parents were when they had you, or you even get older than the lifespans of some of the people in your own family and personal history, there's an urge to document them, to tell their stories, to delve into the stuff that made them, and to, I suppose, to kind of find out what the stuff of your own DNA is made of. And so I'd been working through this stuff in prose form, in essays and short memoir pieces before, but then, God bless them, the Arts Council of Ireland gave me a literature bursary award to pursue this further. So I went to study at the Hem of Anne-Marie Curran to see what I could steal from poetry and what I could learn. And she, in the most Galadriel way, sent me to boot camp and helped me with the refine the prose and make it musical and to steal the tricks that poets have to turn something into a sort of a fever dream.
Boot camp with Anne-Marie Curran. I'm finding it hard to, well, hard or easy to imagine that. What was that like?
Some of the best notes I've ever received from an editorial figure, because her bedside manner is perfect. It's both no nonsense, stern, kindly, encouraging, and lateral thinking in terms of sending you places to read in order to further understand what she's suggesting or what she's, how she thinks your work might benefit from a look at, you know, such and such.
Cullum, you've known Peter for a long time now at this stage. When did you meet for the first time?
I think we met in the 90s. Neither of us can remember, probably, quite. But yeah, early mid-90s perhaps.
Mid-90s we began speaking. I was a fan of the Frames and knew all that mob, Keela and Mick Christopher and the Frames family from about 89 or 90. I moved to Dublin in 91, and the first week I moved up I saw the Frames in McGonagall's the night before the Gulf War kicked off. There was something incredibly there's a lot of bravado about that show, and I was at all those early Frames gigs in the Bag It In. And through then, when I started writing about music for Hot Press, as well as playing in bands at the time, I think we played a couple of gigs supporting the Frames as well. I was in a band called the Tulips that opened up for
the Frames
in the Tivoli. So when I began then as interlocutor, talking to the guys, just gradually over the years, over various missions, we became friends. And then Colin moved down to Wexford. I went back to Enniscorthy from Dublin.
And so when it comes to a project like this, Colin, Peter's already started working on the words. What do you do then to create a soundscape that goes with it?
Yeah, I think I was in a suitable space because I hadn't really, I just got off a plane from Sydney, and where I'd been for, I think it was like a 6-day turnaround to Sydney and back. So actually the headspace I was in suited quite well the kind of semi-dream state, fever dream that Peter was inviting me into. For my part, all I needed to be was to be, you know, to listen, to be sympathetic to the story and to facilitate its telling, really. And just from a point of view, it's not really about a score as such or music. It's more of a, like, it's kind of like a sound design, nearly. It's a theatre piece. So there are fragments of music motifs that appear and disappear and reappear, iconic hooks that come to the ear here and there, but in a way that's kind of it's fleeting, and it was a real joy, a real kind of leap of trust between the musicians and Peter, because it was all kind of pretty much recorded live over 4 days, and with Lorcan and Killian, who are fantastic musicians as well.
You make that sound quite reactionary, that in terms of not having an enormous amount of time to think about the text and then to let it settle with you, that instead you just went with how it worked for you, how it made you feel.
Yeah, I think that was, you know, I think Peter obsessing over it is enough, do you know? And I think, you know, there are some times when you really do need to obsess over it, and other times you're far more useful coming in cold and unattached to what it should be or what it could be. And that it's therefore it kind of acquired kind of a huge amount of, I think, spontaneity and stuff that just fell out in the moment. And it was really very enjoyable recording experience.
Peter, your parents and your brother John are some of the ghosts that you conjure up in this story. But when you were rewriting, you were sent some words that your father had written himself.
Yeah, in between sending Anne-Marie the first draft and getting her notes back, my sister Imelda sent me an essay that my father had written at age 12, which was collected in, I think, the Dulcis project, the schools project that happened in, I don't know how long it went on for, but this was 1938. So it was completely coincidental. She had no idea what I was working on, but it was one of maybe, I don't know, six or seven strange, synchronicitous, eerie things that went on during this process. And it was a slightly surreal thing of seeing my father's writing style in his own hand. I'd never read a word he'd written as an adult, even though he was incredibly inventive with language and very wry and very funny. But it was almost like getting messages from the beyond or something. And I found myself in a weird way looking at him as a child, reading his words as a child, me as a grown man going, not a bad prose style there. Yeah, it was pretty tight. Those lines are not bad.
Did it in any way nudge the trajectory of what you were doing with the project at the time?
It was more like a confirmation and a means of being brave, I think, and also just the sense that there was, if I needed any proof that this stuff was needed to be documented, here it was. And we all feel that, like, so all families have their own historian. Imelda, my sister, is our one. But this was almost like a surrealistic version of history. And in some ways, I mean, this crew that were assembled, Morona from the visual aspects, Killian and Lorcan. I had played and improvised on stage with Killian and Lorcan before. I played and improvised on stage with Colm. Colm had used Killian and Lorcan on his album. So this was a team that was waiting to be assembled. But it's a big ask of people to sort of go and step out on the water and expect that you'll be borne up. But those 5 days of recording were incredibly intensive, but in a gentle way. It was like some sort of seance or something.
And why the National Opera House in Wexford?
Something about the positioning of it, the grandeur of the building, and that building has its own repertoire of ghosts in there. We were using a rehearsal room, and one side of the rehearsal room is glass, which allows you a panoramic view of the town and Wexford Harbour. And it can't help but kind of give you a sense of your smallness and the vastness of things, and a sense that, yeah, what you're doing here is important, but it's just a drop in the sea. And everyone goes through this experience of trying to figure out who they are in relation to their parents and immortality and all that stuff.
It's been lovely to talk to both of you tonight, Peter Murphy and Colm McConamara.
Pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on Arena. Ghost Voltage will be performed live this Saturday at the Wexford Arts Centre. And there's also going to be an exhibition of Mirona Mara's images and a book launch as well. The album is available to download at Bandcamp. And for more details of the live event, wexfordartscentre.ie. Raised in Walkinstown in Dublin, Khaki Kid has been open about his journey to reconnect with his Arab-Irish roots and identity. Displacement and belonging run right through his music. You might have seen him on The Late Late Show or at Electric Picnic this year, and this November he has his first headline gig at the Three Olympia Theatre in Dublin. Before I talk to him, let's have a listen to his breakout single. This is Date Night.
2, 3, 4. Push around like the Trojans, lock forces on when it's day night. You got cheating, I covered in gold, never seen these roses in daylight. Got half the got weak at the knees and some low waist jeans with a frightening waistline. I know that you're feeling me, what you let go of is not when you see me. Is it that hooked in these jeans, money and dreams, I guess that you haven't been dreaming. Let's get going, forget my friends, just go back Vinny, he's busy with money. Let's get going, forget your man, you in love, but who do you fancy?
Wanna see you with me. I got your guidance, don't mean I know your name. This bed was made of crying. In my mind you're running games. If you're trying to get your steps in, let's do the walk of shame.
Any kid over 6 in a tracksuit. That's a little more than slightly embarrassing. Ask my mom.
That's part of Date Night from Khaki Kid, who's with me in studio now. Welcome along to Arena.
Thank you very much for having me. That intro made me sound very thoughtful and pensive.
And I didn't even mention the 25 million streams on Spotify.
You didn't need to.
There it is. How did all of this start for you? What stage did you think that music might be something for you?
I always thought it was going to be a thing for me until I got into it. And then, like, I was super confident right before getting into music. I feel I'm envious of how confident I was when I started. I thought every song I dropped was going to be 25 million streams. But then what made me realize that it was tangible was the live shows and seeing, like, you can get streams or whatever, but, like, people actually buying tickets and putting it in their calendar that they're going to come to your gig is pretty crazy. And if it's 50, 100 people, it's kind of every show I do, I'm like, why are you people here?
I more kind of mean early on, at what stage did you think, you know, oh, I quite like the idea of being a musician and maybe hip hop's for me?
8 years old, yeah. The classic in the bathroom, rapping to yourself in the mirror, singing in the mirror. And there was like 7 people in my gaff, sometimes 8. But one bathroom was, I was like a nuisance. I shouldn't have been doing that.
Who were you listening to at that stage? Who were your influences when it came to wanting to be a musician?
I loved it was mostly rap music. It was mostly 50 Cent, which is, of course, I was 8 years old. I loved that. But then there was a few random songs I would hear around my life that I also loved. Like, I loved Johnny Cash, Hurt for some reason. Then I would go back to Tupac. And then I would listen to Natasha Bedingfield, Unwritten, go back to rap music. And then it would be like, If I Were a Boy by Beyonce, for some reason, I just loved that song as well. But it was mostly rap other than that.
You went to college and it didn't necessarily work out for you. I read that story. Tell us about that.
So, yeah, 6 years was a big deal for me. I made a point to study a lot. I got grinds. I did extra subjects. I did applied maths and all of that. And then I got the points I wanted and I got accepted for financial maths in UCD. And then I did the worst thing I could and I lied to my mother and told her I was going, but I deferred my course. And after 2 months, she was like, you're not going to college. And I told my mother the worst thing you could tell them as to why you're not going to college. I said I was going to become a rapper and I felt really bad for her. And I knew if I were a parent in that situation, I would slap my kid. I wouldn't let it happen. Like, it wouldn't be happening.
What was her reaction at that point? Because obviously it's a different story now. But when you said that to her, how did she take that?
Literally that. Like, do you know? I had a job. I wasn't just bumming it out. You know, I was, and I've been an ambitious person my whole life. So like, she, if I wanted to do something, she knows I would do it. But I feel really bad for her because the music was really bad. It was terrible. I'm most confident. The music was the worst.
Do you think there's a correlation between that your level of confidence at that point, you know, now that you're at a stage where you're actually creating music that you quite like, you're a little bit more reticent to let it out into the world?
I feel like there's like an arc of like confidence and competence, you know, and when you, or knowledge and no knowledge, and when you get to the point where you become knowledgeable, you realise you don't know everything, you know. It takes a while to get to the point where you realise you're not competent. And so you, instead of realizing how much better you are as you develop, you realize how little you know. And so that's kind of the arc there. So I think I'm better now and less confident, which I'm happy I'm not as confident, you know?
In terms of Irish hip hop right now, it's going through this extraordinary burst of creativity in the last 4 or 5 years and beforehand as well. How do you see yourself fitting in to what's happening? And both in terms of Irish music and Irish hip hop as well.
I'm just another artist. I'm another perspective. I'm another Irish artist, importantly. And I feel like Irishness comes in so many different forms, and I'm just one of them. And it's great to be a part of it, you know? It's great to see other people make rap music from different perspectives with different accents, and then just music as a whole. Like, I just love Irishness, and I'm really happy that there are acts that are huge now that happen to be Irish, you know?
What's the writing process like for you? Because it obviously slightly differs because you're a hip-hop artist. Is it a long process? Is it a short process? You go through it, knock it out, and then you're finished. How does that work for you?
It's both long and short, yeah. For me, in the last couple of years, I've made a goal to be like more observant in regular life. So now a lot of my songs will start from this list I have on my phone. So if someone says something to me interesting in a conversation, if I'm listening to a podcast, watching a movie, and someone says a word or a phrase that's interesting, I'll write it down, and then I'll go to that list, and I might spark the idea for a song. Like the other day, my girlfriend's friend, she had met her dog for the first time, and she said, if I had tears, I'd be crying. And I was like,
that's going somewhere.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I don't know why that's beautiful. It's an album title, it's a song, it's a lyric. If I had tears, I'd be crying.
In terms of the style of the music you create, you're not really boxed into one particular place. It ranges far and wide, doesn't it?
Yeah, I need to lock in though, to be honest. I need to cop on and just pick a sound.
Do you think so?
Every now and again. Like, I think it is, for me personally right now, I think I've found what I like to sound like. And then, of course, I'm going to experiment more and more. But I've come across a sound I quite like recently.
The Dublin you describe in your lyrics, it feels very real, it feels very messy, it feels funny, it feels grounded, it feels... How much does that sense of place shape the sort of music that you write?
I think it's 100%, if not more somehow. But like, even if I'm not talking about Dublin, who I am is Ireland, it is Dublin, so it's inescapable. Like, even my perspective on anything you could ask me about a movie... And whatever way I describe that, it's going to be molded by my upbringing, my Irishness, you know?
By Walkinstown.
By Walkinstown. Germany Castle.
You've talked before, we've discussed this earlier. You talked before about artists like Tyler the Creator and The Streets, about them being influences in terms of what it is that you do. Like, what have they taught you about building your own songs and your own world as an artist?
That your most valuable asset is yourself. You know, like, I feel, for myself anyway, when I got into music, I looked up to so many artists and I decided, oh, I'm going to be that artist. I'll be Andre 2000 because he's my favourite artist and he's the best. So let me be him. But why Andre 2000 is so, why I love him so much is because he's so himself, you know? And so Tyler the Creator, The Streets, my favourite artists have always been themselves.
You've got a huge headline show coming up at the 3 Olympia. You're shaking your head as I say that, as if you don't believe that's a thing that's going to happen. Do you live for performing life?
that's sometimes I prefer that than making music full stop. Like if I could somehow perform live and not make songs, it would be perfect. Maybe I'll be a tribute act or something. But yeah, playing live is my favorite part of making music often. And when I got into music, I had printed out a picture of the Tree Olympia in black and white and sellotaped it to my wall with duct tape because it was something I dreamed of doing, and now I'm doing it, and that's why I shook my head because it seems unbelievable.
Another thing your mum probably wasn't hugely happy with, duct taping stuff like that to your wall.
Listen, it was covering up the holes in the wall, so yeah.
I want to play the new track. It's called Don't Touch the CDJ. It sounds different to the music that you've played before. Maybe tell us about it.
Yeah, I wanted to make some dance music for our festivals, and that's where I decided to make Don't Touch the CDJ, and it stemmed from the first line. It's something my friend's uncle said to him, or yeah, something like that. And he said, if I went out for a fight, I went out for a fight and a disco broke out. And I was like, what does that mean? That is beautiful. I don't know. And then just took that one line and made an entire song out of it.
Okay, let's have a listen to that. That's Cracky Kid, Don't Touch the CDJ. Is this the start of a new sound for you?
No, this is a once-off, 100%. I'm sorry if anyone really likes this. But no, this was a once-off. Maybe we'll do it again at some point. But yeah, this was a bit out of my character. I love making it. I love the song, but yeah.
Thanks for coming in and talking to us tonight on Arena. Thanks to Cracky Kid. His new single, Don't Touch the CDJ, is out now. You can catch him live at the Cork Jazz Festival on October 24th and 26th. His first headline show is at the Three Olympia in Dublin on November 27th. And you can get ticket details at ticketmaster.ie. That's it for Arena for tonight. Produced by Sinead Egan. Our research was by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Anna Rose Charlton was our broadcast coordinator. And Paul Murnock was on sound. I'm Rick O'Shea. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7 o'clock. And John Creedon is next.